I'm Nicolien Berger.
And I'm Jana Vosloo.
And this is Air It.
Hello, Nicolien.
Hello, Jana, and welcome to our Air It listeners. I somehow gonna fall with the foot in the deer like last time as well.
Yes, let's get straight into
okay.
it.
Okay, so let me tell you guys about the topic we're discussing today. I have a gig now that I'm working for a Swedish company that has an art blog, and they basically make their money through SEO searches on Google, keyword searches, and I write articles for them around those keywords. So most of the time they work with me, and they actually allow me to create quite cool articles around subjects that I want to write with. But obviously we have to kind of like work with the Google algorithm and the keywords and stuff. But also there's so many art pieces that I've had to write about that's part of the Western canon of art history, which is the most kind of famous storyline of art history that's been written about endlessly. And I get the opportunity now to write basically whatever I want to write about those artists, and as long as I use the keywords. But then I've been having this inner conflict in me about perpetuating the kind of highlighting of the Western canon by writing about it yet again. And also this tension, I just have to mention, if you guys can hear the birds tweeting outside, there's so many starlings that have gotten babies outside my studio. They're literally above the door and they're making so much noise. So I apologize for that. But spring is here. And so I also have this conflict of, I get paid per 1,000 words. So obviously, as much as I can write, the more I get paid, which is great. I am in charge of that. But with what often happens is that I cannot do like days and days and weeks of research. So I go to the most credible sources on the artists that exist, and I kind of write what is there. And more often than not, it's not really like at all from a decolonizing perspective framework that I'm interested in, or, you know, kind of contextualizing the artists post Me Too and post COVID. And so what I've started doing is I kind of just put a disclaimer on every single article stating that let's just acknowledge that Western, like European men, had the most support, the most financial support. They had a lot of freedoms and stuff to explore this, and therefore they created this art that influenced the world. But also they drew a lot of influence from other cultures, which are often not mentioned, and is very difficult to trace back to, because back then they didn't say where they actually got, you know, the African mask that influenced Picasso, whatever. It's kind of just like this tribe, you know, has influenced Picasso, which is super problematic. And it's very difficult for us to actually go back and know, like, what made Picasso Picasso, you know. And then I also flag that a lot of these artists, like I recently wrote about Picasso, and I was like, there's a lot of questions around, can we separate the artist from the art? Because he was a womanizer and a chauvinist, and he treated the woman in his life really badly. And yeah, so just saying that as well. And then of course I write the articles the way that my employers expect. So it's good because I get the opportunity to kind of reframe them. And in the beginning I thought I wasn't going to learn much, but now I've been learning quite a bit. And I wanted to share a specific topic that was really interesting to me, which I can get into now, but that was a little intro monologue, Jana. I don't know if you want to say anything about the Western canon, or, I don't know, have a question for me. Oh, you're muted.
I think that is so fascinating, your story, and like the struggle of having to produce content, but also that inner conflict of wanting to firstly, like, add something original and new to what's been such an oversaturated kind of blog like all
space.
those blog posts on you know, the canon. And I think I relate a lot to that temptation of like how you go about dealing with the canon. It's something that in philosophy, just like in art, I think they have that in common, where it's so tempting to just start explaining philosophy by looking just at the canon, and then it almost takes forever to be able to come to the point of thinking about it in our contemporary society. So I definitely think there's a lot of similar examples. And yeah, I think as you said, today we will chat a bit about also how different the influences of an artist, and how you can you separate that from the artwork. And yeah, so tell me about what are one of the key kind of stories that you've now come across of an artist and their influences that you'd like to maybe problematize here.
Okay, cool. So then I wrote about Marcel Duchamp last week, and I'll talk about his importance now for those who don't know, because he's like famous for like, I want to say very obvious reasons, the way that he influenced the timeline of art is kind of like the story like comes out of art students' ears. You know, we know how the fountain and the ready-made changed the trajectory of art, and I'll expand on that now. But what came up for me was this woman that potentially made the fountain and also came up with the concept of the ready-made. She didn't call it the ready-made, but she came up with the concept of it. And then I was like, wow, okay. I was sneaky because I had to write 3,000 words on Marcel Duchamp, and 1,000 of those words I gave to this woman. And I just kind of worked her into the structure of the article, saying like I had all these controversies. Like the first controversy that Marcel Duchamp's career was the nudist standing the staircase, a painting that he made that kind of had futurist and Dada styles, and it had a lot of movement, and it was super shocking to the Parisian salon kind of people. And he basically left the Dadaist group from the Paris Dadaist group, which his two brothers were also part of.
You should just quickly explain Dadaism to our listeners who might
that
not
as
know.
Well, geez, okay. So Dadaism was a art movement that wanted to it was between the First and the Second World War, and they wanted to make the art as absurd to reflect the absurdity that they felt from society. So they felt that everything was completely nonsensical, didn't make any sense, and they wanted to create art that was absurd as what they perceived reality to be. So the whole purpose of Dadaism was nonsensical art. So Dada was just also like, you know, like the word doesn't actually even mean anything. It's a sound, and there's other kind of meanings that people have interpreted it, but the main thing is that it was just like Dada, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And he and his and the one thing that they also did was they started with like tearing up pieces of paper, and then they would drop it, and then where it drops you have to stick it down. It was kind of these chance by chance collages that they made, and there was this whole thing of like kind of keeping everything up to interpretation, and also very random, and that the artist almost did nothing. And then Marcel Duchamp painted this painting, which was it was a Dadaist work because he was part of the Dadaist movement, but it actually had influences from Cubism and it had influences from Futurism, and that is what shocked the people. So he said, after they basically did not allow him to exhibit this painting, that already like a few years after they've established this movement, which is supposed to be nonsensical and non-directional, the group of Dada themselves had this very rigid structure. They'd already figured out the rules and the structure, and he was very upset about that, because like, what is the whole purpose of creating a movement without structure? And now you're saying, well, this is not structureless enough, you know? So then Duchamp basically left Paris and went to New York, which was the new scene for kind of like the avant-garde contemporary art movement, and they were really quickly surpassing France and what was happening there. And a part of, I just need to open my notes because there's so many names, which I'm really bad at remembering names of by heart, but he basically started a society there. He was a founder of society there called the Society of Independent Artists. And it's very similar to the society he had in New York. And the idea with the society was that they would have an exhibition that anyone that pays the membership fees, it was like a, I think it was like $6 in total that you had to pay, like application to be part of the exhibition, and then a yearly fee of $5. But anyone that paid that could submit the work to this exhibition. And it was the first completely independent exhibition where they said that we're not going to claim who can and cannot be an artist. It's a free for all. And then Marcel Duchamp, because he was on the committee of the board, he also suggested that they exhibit the works alphabetically, so that there's no one deciding what works are more important than others. So then the story goes, the typical story of the fountain ready-made goes, let me just maybe what a ready-made is as well. So a ready-made is basically an artwork that is something that already exists, that is then slightly altered by the artist. That could just literally be to like turn it upside down or something. So slightly altered by the artist, put on a pedestal, and now it's an artwork. So it's already made. It's a ready-made artwork. And the famous one is the fountain. So I'm going to tell the typical story of the fountain now, and then I'm going to tell you about the Baroness Elsa.
I'm so intrigued.
Yeah, I know. I love this story. So the typical story goes that because Marcel Duchamp was basically asked to not exhibit or remove his application of the new Descending the Staircase at the Parisian Society of Independent Artists, when he got to New York, he exhibited this painting again. Again, it caused a lot of controversy, but then through the controversy, his name kind of spread throughout New York, and then a group of artists and him decided to start the society with this exhibition, the first exhibition of independent artists, basically. So the story goes that he secretly decided with one of his other friends, Walter Arensberg, that the idea kind of came out of a discussion with him, that to test the society's commitment to receiving and putting on show every single application of someone that pays a fee, they decided to submit this urinal, which they put upside down and signed Armat, or like not upside down, but with a flat side on a pedestal. And so a woman, which for a long time people believed was one of Marcel Duchamp's friends, took this thing in. And then the directors were at an exhibition. They were extremely upset about this thing because they were like, a urinal is a functional object. It cannot in any world be an art piece. And they voted on behalf of the board to hide the fountain. So they hid the fountain behind a partition in the exhibition space. And then when Marcel Duchamp found out that the directors had voted on behalf of the board, he and his friend Walter basically resigned in protest from the Society of Independent Artists and exposed them as not only deciding or stating that they will not decide who can be an artist, but kind of censoring what still can be art. And he was like, aha. So how can you say anyone can be an artist if you are still deciding what and what cannot be art? So this was huge.
The drama.
The drama. This was huge because for the first time ever on the scene of the art history Western canon, who knows what happened in the rest of the world, but there, it was possible for artists to use functional objects in their art. And after this, I mean, we know art today, like anything can be art. And this fountain, ready-made art piece sculpture basically catalyzed what we understand in the contemporary moment is that anything can be art, and really made art like boundless and limitless. And this is also, Marcel Duchamp, he was a very interesting guy. So even if he basically stole this idea from someone else, potentially, he was a very interesting guy because he wanted to constantly have conversations in his time as an artist of what is the limits of art and what can artists do. And he constantly wanted to push the limits of art to be boundless as we understand them today. Right.
Deep breath. Cool. I'm okay. Still with you.
You're still with me. Okay.
Are so we now moving on to the second version of events?
We're working on to the the conspiracy, controversy. And I must say, the proof might be in the pudding. And it is quite scary when I read all of this. So apparently, there was a woman in the scene during this time, in the art scene in New York. And I need to get my notes again because her name is even more difficult to say. Her name was Elsa, Baroness Elsa. Sorry. Just give me a moment. Yes. Baroness Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven. So we can talk about why they didn't include her in art history, but I have a very strong feeling that pronouncing names is also like one of those
thinking
the difficulty of names.
Because she needed a stage name.
Yeah. And
von.
Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven. Okay, so she was born in Prussia, which is now part of Germany. And was a very interesting teenager. She had a lot of like a bad relationship with her parents, so she ran away as a teenager and kind of went to Berlin and traveled in Germany. And then she was, her whole life she kind of wanted to be against the norm. She did get married 3 times, and where her story gets really interesting is with the marriage of her second husband. They were quite in debt when they lived in Europe, and then she helped him fake his own death and then moved to the US, and that's kind of how the US chapter started. And it seemed that this husband then deserted her when they got to the US, a year after they got to the US, and she had to fend for herself and kind of survive. And one way that she survived was by doing art modeling in New York. So she lived in Philadelphia, and then she kind of modeled for artists in New York. And then she married a baron who only had a title to give her, the Baron Freytag von Loringhoven. And he basically only had the title to give her. So she continued to model, and she also worked in a cigarette factory. And through her art modeling gigs, she often went to the apartment of Walter Arensberg. So Walter Arensberg was the guy that resigned from the Independent Society of Artists with Marcel Duchamp when his quote-unquote art piece was rejected. So of course, at his apartment, she met Marcel Duchamp. He was there, and the who's who of the New York art scene was at this guy's apartment. And it was here that she kind of created this incredible poetry that had a lot of onomatopoeia, and it was very direct and frank and sexual and often scatological. And she was also a collector of things, stuff. And if you Google her name, you see she often dressed in this like very strange dress, and then also had like everyday objects attached to her costumes. And this, so the theory is that she birthed the idea of the ready-made in this community at that time, just before the 1917 exhibition where Marcel Duchamp had caused this whole controversy with the fountain. And she didn't call it the ready-made, but she collected items, and then she altered them slightly, attaching them to each other and then putting them on pedestals. And she created artwork there. She actually became famous in the downtown New York scene for these sculptures that she created out of scavenged objects. And this was all in 1913, kind of, she created her first real ready-made. And that was, she, on her way to a wedding, she saw this construction ring thing, which she picked up and then used in art. And that was kind of like the first one documented of hers. And this was a year before Marcel Duchamp made his own first ready-made,
okay,
the bottle rack. Yes. So the first documentation of a ready-made ever made was hers. And then he made it. So what could be possible is that they're in an art scene together, they're like hanging out, and they're all sharing ideas. And of course, this idea of the ready-made is spreading around. Marcel Duchamp gives it a name, which is very important. And he calls this the ready-made. And so what she basically did with the ready-made is that she took these ordinary objects and then made them objects of formal beauty. So she would alter them slightly and then put them on a pedestal or attach them to her clothing. And the idea is that she created the fountain as well, or the idea of the fountain, and also had the idea to submit it to this exhibition of the Society of Independent Artists. And okay, so now I'm going to go on to the proof. So
Okay.
how they've proved that she potentially created this. And the proof is that Marcel Duchamp himself wrote a letter to his sister saying that one of his female friends sent in an object that is a urinal that she signed, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with the object, and the society rejected it, and how upset he was about it. So now there's obviously a lot of people fighting around what this means. Like, she sent it in. Some people say that she sent it in, but he could have asked her to send it in because they were friends. They also say that so Marcel Duchamp has famously had an alter ego called Arrow C'est la Vie, and this Madame C'est la Vie only really appeared in his artistic career from the 1920s, where he's created these famous portraits of her dressed up as her. So some people say that Arrow C'est la Vie could have been a character that he was already developing, and that he submitted it himself and then just dressed up as his alter ego. And some say that he didn't want to expose this even to his sister because of the controversy of a man dressing up as a woman. And others then say, well, it could have just been Elsa. Okay. So, and then there's another, the further proof is that the artist that took the photos, the famous photos of the fountain. Because what I must say is that the fountain disappeared right after it was photographed, a few days after the opening of the exhibition. So Marcel Duchamp found the fountain behind the partition, was very upset about it, and he took it to his famous photographer friend who photographed it. And that is the famous image that we know today. And it's the only image of the real one that exists. Everything else that exists is replicas, which Marcel Duchamp himself approved that people could create replicas, which I'll get to now. So this photographer that took this famous picture also confirmed that a woman submitted this artwork. Okay. And let me just look at this. Oh, yes. Okay. So another piece of proof is that the name that they scribbled on it, Armat,
I've also heard about
they
that part.
tracked. Yes, they tracked it, and it was this Richard Matt who lived in Philadelphia. That's the only like person with that the initials they found, and he was like a fellow in Philadelphia, and who lived in Philadelphia at the time. Our Baroness lived in Philadelphia at the time, and her handwriting in her poetry matches the handwriting on the sculpture as well. And
Wasn't it also
oh.
say that her pseudonym, her own pseudonym was Armat or something like that?
So that I haven't read. I don't know if people took it further, saying that, like, took that further when they figured out that Armat was someone in Philadelphia and she lived in Philadelphia. That's all that I kind of read and came across. But it could be that people then assumed that her pseudonym was Armat. What makes this whole thing more complicated? Oh, something else, a further proof was that she famously collected pieces of plumbing. So another artwork that I'll talk about now, called God, which someone else almost nearly stole from her as well, was also a piece of plumbing, and she famously collected plumbing stuff. And what makes this super complicated is that because the original was lost, it was this whole thing of like, where is it in the time that they were alive? And then only in 1950 did Duchamp claim the fountain as his own. That was conveniently after the Baroness's death, and also after the death of the photographer that affirmed that was involved in taking the picture right in the heat of the moment. And even though André Breton accredited the fountain to Duchamp in 1935, it was only 25 years later that Marcel Duchamp himself started issuing permission for them to create replicas and claiming this work as his own, and started talking about this work as his own. And another detail that's a little bit weird is that Duchamp, when he started claiming the work as his own and telling the story of it, because he was part of the board for a long time, he kept it secret. And he said that was the reason he kept it secret, because he was part of the Society of Independent Artists. All very convenient, it sounds to me. So then when he started telling the story, he said he purchased the urinal from a company called J.L. Mott Ironworks Company, and that he changed Mott to Mutt to refer to that. But none of the in none of the catalogs of the time was that model urinal listed under this J.L. Mott Ironworks company. So there's no proof that they sold this. They just say they sold other urinals. They didn't sell this model urinal. So yeah, and oh, the other thing is also that the Baroness re regularly referenced plumbing in her poetry as well. So there's quite a few things like this that is a little bit weird.
This feels like
And
a true crime art episode. Like,
yeah, it does. And what I found so interesting was that it's a massive fight. Like, people get extremely upset about this. If you go read, it gets so upset. They get so upset about it. And what the lady Jennifer Dassel from Art Curious said that I found so interesting is the controversy is not just necessarily that he stole it from her, but it seems like the controversy is that what would it mean for art history if a woman created this pivotal artwork that changed the entire course of art history? And some even say that if it was rightly accredited to her in that time, the art piece wouldn't have been as influential as it was today, which is really interesting for me to think about. And another thing that was interesting in this research that I did was that, besides the fact that she was a woman, and this was a massive downfall, and to a certain extent could still be seen as something that the art world kind of complicates, you know, that when artists are women and create things, and is that she wanted to monetize her work. So she would often design these art pieces as to still be functional, which was a big difference from how Marcel Duchamp thought of the ready-made. He kind of framed them as high art pieces, and because of that, created value for them that was way bigger. But because she had to sell these sculptures to the downtown New York art scene, she often sold them at a very little price, low price. Not a lot of them survived because they were sold to people. And this monetizing of it, and also kind of infusing art into everyday life, which is something that we today see as like very cool, you know, then was kind of what made her not become famous, because this idea of high art, high society was very in. So I thought that this was very interesting, that a woman that was trying to empower herself by selling the things that she made actually shot herself in the foot, you know, because if she had just like been snotty about it and been like, this is high art and it's not functional ever, then maybe she would have become famous, or people would have valued her in a different way. Who knows? And this is also very interesting to me, that she was trying to empower herself and then it didn't work.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because it raises a lot of questions about authorship, and then also about, so yeah, the tension between authorship and I guess like representation as a feminist ideal of like accrediting work. And because women are so underrepresented, it's not that they are under, you know, it's not like they weren't there, they were just not acknowledged. So I was also thinking of this whole idea that also arose, I guess, in a similar time period. Let me just double check this, but the famous French literary critic Roland Barthes, which you might also remember
Yeah, I know the name.
from visual studies. He wrote this article about death of the author, and that's like such a famous concept of the fact that when we read texts or artworks, he argued that it's limiting to to even care about, you know, the biography of the author, who they were, you know, married to, all of these little details for him imposed some kind of limit on the text. So as you were saying, most of the Dadaist art and all of that of like making art boundless, what's interesting is that this theorist also said by caring about authorial intention, you are also limiting art. So it's interesting that they...
Someone is phoning me. I don't know if you can hear this. I'm sorry.
We can quickly pause if you want to answer.
No, I don't. I think it's spam, but I tried to set it on my computer so that it doesn't ring on my computer, but it still rang on my computer. So anyway, it's fine. I'll just decline it. Did you hear the noise?
Yeah, it's fine. Don't worry. We can go on. So basically, just what I wanted to say was, it is interesting between maybe this whole idea of death of the author is also a very, in a way, patriarchal idea, because it's like an easy way to also, you know, discredit all the women that have been influential, and not even women, probably also not only women. Like, I'm sure there's a lot of stories about queer people or anyone who wasn't at that time recognized.
Absolutely.
That we now don't know about. Same with people of color. So I think that poses another dimension to the conversation, and like to rethink how we think about authorship.
Yeah, and I want to expand on that, because this is something else that I've been struggling with, as well as the beliefs that I have around making art kind of are in contradiction to each other sometimes around the idea of authorship, you know, because if you think of art, if you look at the purpose of art through the trajectory of art history, and you start from the classical art, first antiquity, and you go, you know, ancient China, Egypt, you go, you know, like even like in Africa, you go to the cave drawings that we have and things like that. Like in that time, art was entirely to connect to the transcendental. It was the realm of the spirits that was accessed through the shaman, that would take, you know, things that altered their states or dance or whatever, and then would communicate to the tribe through these symbols that they would draw. And there the author wasn't involved at all, because it was understood that God or the spirits were channeling messages through the shaman or through the artist to then relay that to the tribe and decipher that to the tribe. And then if you go even like to the Gothic periods, and when they built those massive cathedrals, again, the entire village worked together to build it and to craft it. Nowhere anyone ever signed those spaces. And a lot of the time the art was created even in nooks and crannies that the human eye would never see, because the whole thing was made for the eye of God, you know?
Yeah.
And so if you look at art as that, as something that is maybe channeling through the artist, then authorship doesn't really make sense. And then it was only during the period of the Enlightenment where we shifted from, you know, out-of-worldly or otherworldly focus, you know, the focus on the realm behind this world, and brought the focus back and put man at the center of the whole universe and existence. That was only when we took the genie out of the wall of the artist studio, like Elizabeth Gilbert says. So there's this TED talk that I find really inspiring by her, where she talks about this idea of the artist not... Yes, you want to say something?
No, you can quickly finish that thought.
Oh, is it time? Okay, cool. So then she said that in the ancient times, when we believed that the muse or the genie was an entity outside of the artist, inspiring the artist, then the artist could release the pressure around them being the genius. And then we took the genie out of the wall and we made the artist the genius. And the reality is that creativity is extremely mysterious. And yeah, I'll expand on this just now. Okay, so what I also wanted to say was that Elizabeth Gilbert and also Julia Cameron and also Dr. Clarissa Pinkola-Estes, all these people that look at creativity from an emotionally sustainable perspective and kind of want to challenge the idea of the struggling artist persona, the tortured artist persona, says that it's important to acknowledge that creativity and ideas come in extremely random ways, and that we, if we hold on so tightly to the originality and my idea, then we kind of block this mystery. And we also get very stuck and torture ourselves, because then if an idea is not coming, then, you know, this whole thing. So I think authorship for identity politics and politics in the world, and kind of the like justice also, it's important to acknowledge who makes things and not. But on a larger scale, if we zoom out and we look at art from just as a human phenomena, that we as humans create these artifacts that say something about our culture, the author kind of falls away, and it's not as important to observe. I don't know. This is the tension that I have.
Yeah, I completely agree with that tension, because I think it's a very almost post-structuralist idea to think of, to acknowledge that, you know, ideas aren't just like formed in isolation, that there's always a sense of intertextuality, that, as you said, like even in those famous circles in the canon, both in art and philosophy, people were sitting in cafes discussing ideas, and that radically influenced their art. So there is this idea that, you know, art, or, you know, it's even novels, whatever, they all are in conversation with each other. And I think that's what post-structuralist art try to make clear. And it sounds like even Duchamp, maybe part of like using someone else's stuff for him wasn't a big deal, because he actually really bought into his own ideas so much so that it was like, this doesn't matter because I'm the one taking the picture or whatever. Like,
yeah. And also the other element of that is that I suppose what made me think of the two of them as a failed power couple of art history is that if they were acknowledged back then as collaborating on this idea in whatever way, whether it was that Marcel Duchamp, because he was very charming and very eloquent, actually pushed this idea post its creation into the world, which then made influence art history, whether that was his involvement or whatever, it would have been a much earlier example of a man and a woman working together in art. And I think this is something that we often don't see in the Western tradition of art history. We know that the artists kind of influence each other and worked alongside each other, but there's not so much emphasis on the collaborative aspect of art.
And ignoring.
And how, yeah.
And I think that is, that is like the feminist idea as well, is that it's not just one aspect is representation or whatever, but it's almost this whole idea of a single person taking, like claiming it, is something that I think...
Which is almost never true.
Yeah, it's, I think that's the part that we are criticizing. And I think there's so many examples of this where, as you said, it would have been very powerful if these women were acknowledged, because it might have changed the ways in which we collaborate today.
Yes.
In which, yes, you know, museums are curated, and maybe even about, you know, money and domestic labor and all of that aspect of it. You know, how a lot of women, there were other factors that played into why they weren't taken seriously at the time.
Yeah, because this is the thing, like one article that I read said that at the time there was this belief that an idea coming from a man was more elevated than coming from a woman, and that women were kind of they kind of made things dirty or murky or muddy with their sexuality and beautifulness, you know, this idea that women are constantly distracting the masculine, you know, linearity from the course of logic, and that they come in and they just kind of flirtatiously, you know, flirt them out of their course and direction that they want to go. And this idea was definitely in the art world as well, because someone also said that the controversy of women seeing a urinal at this exhibition where the fountain was rejected was one of the motivations that the directors had for voting it out. It was that, women can't see a male urinal in public space with other males around. The scandal, you know.
Yeah.
But to think that a woman could have thought of that idea and the provocative aspect of this urinal in public space, and that she collected it, handled it, and made it an artwork was like entirely like unbelievable. So it was almost like it was impossible for them to even think that a woman could think that and do that.
Yeah, so it really like limits the, it shows how limited the imagination was about a woman's artistic and intellectual capacities. And I think that's also another example that I'm thinking of is with Alfred Hitchcock, the famous film director. And I think there's now been two movies that have come out. I think the one is just called Hitchcock. I'm not sure about the other one, but where they actually show how his wife, Alma Reveal, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but I mean, she was a film director even before Hitchcock. She was in the industry even before Hitchcock was. And there's like so much information out there about how she was the one writing stuff, coming up with concepts. I think even the famous like Psycho sounding and like killing scene, I think there was a mistake in what they filmed it in the one shot. They could actually, you could see the woman breathing after she was dead, and like she noticed that, and I think she influenced that whole addition of the sound that's now made it so famous. And she was also never really acknowledged, or when you hear, I mean, I think even when we did film studies in visual studies, we looked at like three Hitchcock movies and never heard about her. So even in our analysis, so that's also like a similar example. And I think now after they've died, like now it's you know, spoken about, and there's more people telling those stories that were not shared then.
But I mean, even the way that we are talking about it now, and the way that it's spoken about, like in articles on the internet and things like that, I feel like that what you said about the imagination being limited then by not imagining that women could create art like this then, we are limited in our imagination of the openness of how art history can be. You know, people are so attached to Marcel Duchamp creating the fountain that it's so challenging for them to even imagine that this woman was part of it. And I feel like we're limited in that, you know, like we're limited in expanding our mind to allow the nuances of how these things actually unfold. And I think that is due to education, the linearity of education, and how we love a timeline in education. And we love being like, okay, Marcel Duchamp created here. And then
that name drop
here.
I feel like in the art circles, if you can be like, oh my word, this is reminiscent of the Champs, the fountain, like just that, like being able to casually bring that into a conversation.
Yeah.
And that's how the canon still functions today, because it adds to that, as you said, art knowledge, art education. And that's something that you've also spoken a lot of, about how important it is to demystify. That kind of
demystify and remystify. I'm very for demystifying and remystify it by allowing the genie and the muse and releasing the control of the ego of like, I thought of this and now I'm a genius, you know. Because there is actually this artwork that I mentioned earlier, it's called God, and it's of a twisted cast iron pipe connected to a box. And another one of Elsa's friends, the Baroness's friends, photographed it. And I thought his name was quite funny. I'm going to tell you now. Let me just see where it is. Morten Schamberg. So Morten Schamberg was a sham, because he photographed this thing also for quote unquote safekeeping. And then years later, he signed his own name on the photographs. And then it was proven that she actually collected the pieces and that he just assembled it for the photographing of it. And now in the Philadelphia Museum of Art, they're both acknowledged as the authors of this artwork, so their collaboration. But I have never heard of that artwork besides reading about this artist. So it's also interesting to me that even though she was acknowledged like post the whole situation in that artwork and made a collaboration, it's not made it more famous or more significant, even though she played a role in the whole ready-made movement, like vital role in it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm also thinking of, like, I can't help to think of, we spoke now about like the idea of like intellectual or artistic power couples. Obviously, there's Frida and Diego, which you probably have a lot to say about as
Yes,
well. I
I have
saw
so much
that
to say about
there's
this.
Frida Art in Joburg at the moment for the first time in South Africa. Frida's art is here.
What?
Yes, just
Like
give me one.
actual real art? Where you
Yes.
go?
And also in philosophy, there's obviously the famous example of Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. And
I
there.
love you to tell me more about that, please, because I read about them as, you know, this they made a whole list of all these power couples when they're in this one article that I read about Elsa. So I
Yeah.
want to know what there's something about the is it the automatic idea or the authentic idea or the there's a specific idea that she actually created, eh?
So, yeah, they are interesting, and I am by no means an expert on the details of their relationship. And I know there's so many, because they were both so, they had such a big oeuvre of prolific writings. And at the time, I think they met in 1929 in Paris. So, same time as all of this, like, post-war art movements going on. And, they were both. They met as philosophy students. They were both philosophy students, both very talented, even in their like early studies. And so Jean-Paul Sartre is more famous for his ex like for almost being like the father of existentialism and existentialist notions of, as you said, authenticity and otherness. And his famous book is called Being and Nothingness. And then Simone de Beauvoir was also, she's also a phenomenologist like Sartre, but she was more famous almost as the founding mother of feminism, second, or like some of the first radically feminist ideas in her book, The Second Sex, where she wrote about her experience of being a woman, and almost gave a descriptive account of how there is no natural idea of a woman, but it's almost like what we've seen with Judith Butler as well, that was influenced by de Beauvoir's idea of the famous quote, one is not born a woman but one becomes one. But I know in a lot of her autobiographies and her diary entries, there's been a lot of information that was revealed about their relationship, because they are like the first people see them as almost the first modern couple, because they were in an open relationship, which was quite radical for that time,
Well,
or
Elsa
quite
was also in an
common.
open relationship.
Quite
The
common,
Baroness's
but
first relationship was open.
yeah, it was quite common, I think. But I think in that world of like talking about it and being so committed to this idea of not marrying, not having children, was still radical at the time. And
Absolutely, it still is
the
sometimes.
So the fact that they were, I think they were in a 51-year relationship with one another. Their open relationship lasted that
Wow.
long until he died, until Sartre died. And so they were challenging tradition. That's the one aspect of it. But the other aspect that's interesting is that their relationship was an intellectual relationship mostly. So I think the reason why they were so attracted to each other wasn't necessarily just because of sex or whatever. Like, they almost fulfilled their other needs of other people, and their relationship was very much about talking about their work, developing content. Like, de Beauvoir edited most of Sartre's work, and obviously she influenced his work and vice versa. And it's interesting because even though de Beauvoir is like this founding mother of feminism in the Western canon, she there's a lot of interviews and stuff with her saying, despite all of her work, like Sartre and their relationship is her greatest accomplishment. And she was very much like, oh, I'm not a philosopher. I am only a disciple of Sartre's philosophy or whatever. So she almost weirdly placed herself in this, almost like a self-deprecating position in terms of her philosophical reputation. But I think like even in some of her earliest diaries and entries, you can already see some key existentialist ideas developing long before Sartre published them and wrote about them. So this is an example where the woman is acknowledged. I think de Beauvoir and Sartre are equally famous, but it blurs the lines between that whole authorship thing because they were so interested in the same themes. And I think another interesting part of it was that the relationship, it was an open relationship, but it was definitely also not, you know, they don't represent it as this seamless fairy tale relationship. Like, there's a lot of interviews as well where de Beauvoir talks about the notion of jealousy and how she sees this, it can be both a good and a bad thing. And they both acknowledged as well that their relationship, this intellectual relationship, came at the expense of others. So they're like third people who were involved with them all got very hurt in the process, apparently, because they were kind of, you know, they were, those people were secondary. They were still like, the most important thing was their long-standing intellectual relationship with one another. So yeah, that's about all that I know, to be honest.
No, but it's like some really interesting thoughts that come out of it, because like what you said about the self-deprecating view of her philosophical achievements is one way of seeing it, where something else that I'm also thinking is that for her, fame and acknowledgement might not have been something that she wanted. If she said that Sartre and her relationship with Sartre was the most successful thing in her life, maybe the idea of that, like, achter elke man there's a vrou, you know, like behind every man there's a woman, and like maybe for her it was extremely fulfilling to be able to inspire and kind of nurture this man to then become the author that he was. Like, I'm just thinking of my role as a creativity doula in some of these senses. Like, a lot of the times I see artists practice ideas that I've given them in sessions, and then it becomes that they're successes. And I had this tension in the beginning of like, oh, shouldn't I get some acknowledgement, you know, like for this thing? And then realizing also that in the moment that I saw this thing happen for them and gave them the idea, I knew that it was only going to work if they executed it. It was an idea for them, you know, in the sense of like their essence being connected to it and it coming out of their oeuvre of work and their way of writing and all of that. So almost like that being behind someone's career and being okay with you not being the famous one, even though she is quite famous, which is just like an interesting thing to think of. And also that it wasn't for her so important to be seen as a philosopher. And another thing that it brought up was, because it's interesting you mentioned Frida and Diego. I might have told you this on another occasion, but I was quite interested in, I wrote about Frida the other day also for Art in Context, a long essay. And in my mind, Frida was always kind of this like woman's icon. She became more famous than Diego, even though he was more famous when they met. And her name and art kind of had a massive influence on how we see psychological, emotional, dreamlike art. You know, she never claimed to be surrealist, but she influenced the understanding of symbology and the subconscious mind in art and all of that. But then I read in her diaries, she often wrote about how her greatest joys were to create a home for Diego, and that the first part of her career where she wasn't as famous, before they had a lot of their falling outs and they just met and they were kind of like in their domestic bliss, her main purpose and joy was to create a comfortable home for him. And she loved doing that. And as a feminist, I had this like guilty feminist moment, because I'm also kind of the kitchen witch. I love being in the kitchen and cooking and cleaning and doing these things. But I also am an independent woman making my own business and career happen. And I often feel like I, you know, like spending time in the kitchen on those things are a waste of time. And then I go into this like, oh, but I know that women spend so much energy domestically and that like actually holds them back from, you know, developing their careers faster. Fasti, what's her surname? Do you know Fasti's surname?
Which one?
The one that wrote the is it master's or PhD on this exact
Fussy
topic?
Carlitz.
Yes, Carlitz.
Yes.
Fussy Carlitz wrote a very interesting paper on actually the data behind domestic labor versus how quickly women then build their careers. And then I'm like, oh, you know, like literally this morning spent in the kitchen could have now gone to, you know, like a new marketing strategy or whatever, and have this tension between like, how much am I allowed to enjoy domestic work? You know?
Yeah.
And then I read about Frida Kahlo, and I know she grew up in a completely different way, and her very conservative Mexican background obviously influenced the things that she thought brought her joy. But still, she took pride in it. She was a very independent and feminist woman in some senses, even though she didn't call herself a feminist. And she's been made this feminist icon. But like the fact that her house is this museum now that's so beautiful is because she spent so much time in the domestic space. And I was like, wow. Okay, so like we're kind of sometimes superimposing these frameworks of feminism onto other women. And actually they were empowered what they did because it wasn't complicated for them. They were like, I like this. I like this.
Yeah. I think that's a cool parallel between the Beauvoir and Kahlo that you just made. And I do think that, as you said, on the one hand, you know, it's one might at first glance think it's almost anti-feminist for this famous philosopher to say, you know, my relationship is my greatest achievement. But on the other hand, I think philosophically, she also meant that in the sense of this existentialist and feminist notion that you exist through the other and the relationship to the other, and therefore things like friendship and love and all of that is on a deep, like fundamental theoretical level, the height of existence. And so it would make sense that then you would value relationships more than a piece of writing. But I actually just found this quote, well, actually two interesting quotes from the Beauvoir that I think relates to what we've just said, because on the one hand, she writes about housework. And there's few tasks are more like the torture of Sisyphus than housework. And just for context, the myth of Sisyphus is also something that I think, I'm now thinking, is it Camus or Sartre that wrote it? But anyway, it was this idea of this man carrying a boulder up a mountain until eternity. So she's saying few tasks are more like the torture of Sisyphus than housework, with its endless repetition. The clean becomes soiled, the soiled is made clean over and over, day after day. The housewife wears herself out marking time. She makes nothing, simply perpetuates the present, eating, sleeping, cleaning. The years no longer rise up towards heaven. They lie spread out ahead, gray and identical. The battle against dust and dirt is never won. But I think it's funny because,
oh my God, I've thought of that so much in my life. I didn't know she actually wrote that, but like that's like, especially
that's
with sweeping,
and
sweeping and laundry, you know, like those things. And I must also say what I said now about enjoying domestic work, obviously, like comes from like my, if I had to frame myself, I live with like four other people that assist. We have one day a week each where we clean. And then we also have one day where a domestic worker comes in to clean as well. So like, obviously the idea of housework to me is like, it is very frustrating sometimes, but I can also choose what I want to do to some extent, you know, some things I can't. But what I was like talking about, like, you know, like cooking for a whole day or like making kombucha for a whole day.
Yeah,
or, like,
but I
things
think
like that.
Yeah, like even though like she's writing about it as this like, you know, never ending thing that is kind of dimming her vibe, but at the same time the fact that she's writing about this shows that she participates in a lot of houseworks and it's part of her reality, and she's writing it about it from a phenomenological like perspective. So it's like her experience of housework is still something that she chose to write about
and it's almost like in that is like the, that like fate of, ach, you know, but this is like Sisyphus' fate, you know, it's like you, like this is how it is, you kind of.
And in another quote, so I think there's an important thing about the distinction between a woman like Frida, as you said, like enjoying homemaking, enjoying all those like beautiful aspects of it, even the work, but at the same time there is also the knowledge that it's something that's been imposed on a lot of women for a long time. And as you said, you and I both now have a different level of freedom when it comes to that, although we can still have a whole conversation about domesticity and
Yeah.
the ways in
And
which
but I must
gender
just say that
operates there.
I must just say that specifically that quote of Frida Kahlo was like she wanted to do these things to create a comfortable home for Diego so he can be the successful artist he
Yeah, so
was.
it was
This was
very
like
directly.
it was like I want to create a home for him to be as comfortable. And she would like took so much pride in like learning how to cook his favorite meals and like would carry it to him, and then be upset and jealous when she gets him there with the model and you know like yeah. So it's interesting. And what was the other quote?
That is interesting. Yeah, I think maybe the next quote would be almost a little bit critical of that, but it is interesting, as you said, that she created the home and that home is now the art piece as well.
And it's credited to her. It's like
Yeah.
this is the thing that Frida Kahlo created in her life, you know,
So her
and how
work is
they
still
must
acknowledged, even though it was
exactly.
Diego.
Yeah. No, it's a glorious place now. And they even locked her room in her inner bed chambers. They locked for 50 years after her. Diego said they must lock it for 50 years and after her death. And then they opened it, I think, in 2004 something. And then it was this huge movement again, like Frida Kahlo awareness of being able to see her dresses and the way she dressed, and also that kind of vanity and the amount of time that she actually spent to look like Frida Kahlo. Like when I read about that as well, like the effort that went into her beauty and her dress and her presentation, which people sometimes like judge women for, and they're like, oh yeah, like you're so vain, like spending like 4 hours in the morning to put on a headdress, you know, things like that. But this is what made her, and this is also what she is now known for.
Yeah.
So this anti-feminist tension came
Yeah.
about for me there.
Yeah, exactly. And like on this tension, the quote that I found, I might not read the whole one, but the beginning speaks to that for me because she says, to emancipate women is to refuse to confine her to the relations she bears to man, not to deny them to her. Let her have her independent existence, and she will continue nonetheless to exist for him also. Mutually recognizing each other as subject, each will yet remain for the other and other. So, and then I feel like I just need to pause to sink that, let that sink in. So that thing about like you will always be an other for one another is a very much like what they both wrote about, but this idea that it doesn't have to be, it's almost like this false dichotomy of the woman is either, in service of the man and she cannot be a feminist, or she is this complete independent thing and we should acknowledge her. But so it's denying the relationships we bear is also is would be missing the point, is what the Beauvoir is saying. So she says the reciprocity of the relations will not do away with the miracles, desire, possession, love, dream, adventures worked by the division of human beings into two separate categories, and the words that move us, like giving, conquering, uniting, will not lose their meaning. On the contrary, when we abolish the slavery of half of humanity, together with the whole system of hypocrisy that it implies, then the so-called division of humanity will reveal its genuine significance, and the human couple will find its true form. That was
Interesting.
long. Does that make sense, or does it
No.
sound?
I mean, it's like I think there's a lot in there to unpack. Like, what does the true form of the couple mean? You know, like, what
Yeah.
is the true form? And also, of course, it is written in a very binary way, which is understandable
Yeah.
from where they came from because it's like the couple is man and female. And
Yeah.
yeah, but it's very interesting. I love that she says that, like, if you destroy the limits that we have by putting each other in like relation to the way of the woman serving the man, then unity and those kind of things will not be destroyed. Right? Is that what she says? It still exists.
Yeah, like so it like something like desire or love or adventure, or the idea of being generous or uniting will not fall away, but
Yeah.
we still
It
need
will come
to,
naturally in the way that it has
yeah.
to, like how it naturally comes.
But the feminist struggle of liberation still needs to be a part of that. I think
Yeah.
it's the important part there. But yeah, anyway, we
Very
just
interesting.
in closing, like this probably so many more contemporary examples of this. Like I know, for instance, Judith Butler,
Wait, are we closing the episode now?
well, my Zoom has 10 minutes left,
I
but
see that, but I have more to
we
say.
can say more, but I'm just adding, we can still continue, but I just wanted to say, like,
Okay.
even though this is an example of a very heterosexual relationship, although I think they were probably more open, like, who knows, Sartre and Beauvoir, probably they were more open than that. But I know, like, for
Yeah,
instance,
I
Judith
suppose
Butler
Colin.
and her partner Wendy Brown, they are also an example of a contemporary power couple that are both very recognized in their more like an as academic and intellectuals. And it's interesting that with them, this type of, it's almost like we are very interested in the drama, the romance of like Sartre and de Beauvoir, and the fact that they are buried together in Paris and people go visit it. And there's almost this like very, there's such a romantic idea to that. Whereas I think like a queer couple like Judith Butler and Wendy Brown, that kind of contemporary hype isn't really there. Like I haven't really read much about. They're often like it's almost like they speak at the same events, but you don't, see them as a couple. You almost see them as these two separate entities of their separate work, although they probably also influence each other. So I think there's definitely also
Definitely
something to be
interesting.
said for the way in which heterosexual couples, power couples, the idea of a power couple have been glorified.
Yeah, definitely.
But add
No, I
whatever
mean,
you want to say.
Well, I know that Zoom is like short, but I just quickly wanted to talk about Jackson Pollock, because this was an interesting example that I also came across, that
Yes.
Krasner was his lover, partner. I didn't read a lot
Say the
about
name
them.
again.
Lee Krasner, I think.
Lee
Let me just
Krasner.
quickly
Okay.
double check it. Krasner, yeah, Lee Krasner. So I watched a video on them a while ago, though, so I can't remember exactly what the relationship was, but they were definitely romantically involved, and she definitely influenced them, and they like kind of created the idea of automatic art, really parallel to each other. But Jackson Pollock obviously is named. I didn't even know her name. Also studying art, like maybe someone mentioned it, but it might have like one line, like remember her and she influenced him. But they basically developed the idea of automatic art, which is the Jackson Pollock style of like throwing painting out in the way that they did. But something interesting that I recently learned about Jackson Pollock and the whole abstract art movement in America was that the government used, specifically the CIA, used the abstract art movement to further their agenda, their American agenda of liberation and absolute freedom and absolute expression during the time of the Cold War. And they basically, the CIA created these shell companies and foundations that bought all of this abstract art and created this massive art movement around abstract expressionism in that time. And I just found it very interesting that Jackson Pollock is like this famous artist now, and we know about him and everything, but he would probably not have reached his fame if the government didn't have this agenda. And the artists at the time didn't even know that this was Rothko also was part of this whole thing. The CIA bought most of Rothko's work through
Oh
like
my God.
these shell companies and made him famous in that time. And all for this motivation of being like, we're not like Russia. Here people can express in any way they want to. Where at the time in Russia, this very like traditional and formal and naturalistic style was still promoted. And none of this freedom was allowed, So abstract expressionism like embodied a very specific political agenda for the CIA. And I found it interesting that it was all men that they supported, and that Lee Krasner was like alive, living with Jackson Pollock at the time in his life, making this art alongside him. And again, the government decided to like choose these men and kind of further their careers. And in that way, it's interesting because, like, I don't know as a woman if I would have liked to find out after all of this happened that my fame was actually due to a political war. And it wasn't, of course, there's a lot of things that influence fame and success and all of that, but and that it isn't, maybe it shows just that we are not really involved in the art world, of how our work is received, and that our skills are actually like, it has a very little influence on how the work is received. And it often is about being at the right place at the right time, and then someone seeing you and you fitting into their motivations and then becoming famous because they have the power of money to like support you and further your career in that way. But I don't know, that tension was just very interesting to me, that Jackson Pollock is the famous one, and again there's this woman behind him, but he actually became famous for this very specific reason.
Yeah,
which is
but
like a
at the same time, as awesome. Even if it even when it is so explicitly like a governmental or political kind of motivation for this art that almost has a kind of propaganda message underlying it, it's not surprising to me that they wouldn't, you know, choose a woman for that. Like, the message is very clear. Exactly that. So I think that's why it's important to share these stories. And I think you are making a difference by, even though you're writing in the canon, if the canon can be rewritten or expanded a little bit differently, there's a lot of power to that. And I think that's almost just where the work begins. And there's probably a lot of people who have done a lot of interesting work about acknowledging, as I said, like, we basically, most people were like, okay, Frida and Diego not, but we're like white examples as well. So like, there's so many untold stories, and it really does make one rethink the notion of the canon and whether it should be on such a pedestal.
Yeah, absolutely. But Diana, this is very interesting. I think that we can end
I learned so much today. I learned so much from you. And I think, yeah, hopefully our listeners, if you know more stories, like, tell us, because...
Yeah, because we, like, again, same with the art and context thing, like, Yana and I commit as much time as we can to researching these things. And of course, the stories we told today are actually also now famous, you know, so it's quite easy to find, and it's within our scope. So it's quite easy to find these stories. And there's always there's an opportunity for you to tell us stories that we don't know. Please do, you know. Yeah. Especially South African stories. You wanted to mention, as the famous power couple, Winnie Mandela.
Nelson Mandela, Winnie Mandela. There's also Ashum Mbembe and Sarah Nuttall. There's so many examples. So yeah, maybe we can also focus on more African examples sometime in the future. But yeah, thanks, Nicolene. And
thank you, Yana.
Thank you for listening.
And everyone else must remember to stay stimulated. Okay, bye.
Erit is a team effort. It is produced by Nicolien Berger and Jana Vosloo. Morgan Leupscher contributes visually by creating beautiful artworks and social media content.
Tabu Krokom produced the intro and outro music. And reach out to us if you have an idea of how Erit can expand.
And remember,
stay stimulated.